Part 3. Changing the Future. Chapter 10. Prologue to the Future. Mass murder begins in the minds of men. Dreams of eradicating the enemy in one's midst or next door, of living in a purified society free of social, cultural, and political human pollutants, of radically refashioning society according to a promissory blueprint, come easily to certain kinds of political leaders and even many ordinary people. But for people to apprehend such goals as a real option, as a legitimate and practical political option, eliminationist possibilities must be part of politics' repertoire, which requires a real-world political context that permits and makes practical the act, and permits and makes practical the thinking. Except for the most wild and vicious dreamers, without such a political context, those exercising power and ordinary citizens alike will rarely even start down the mental pathway of considering how eliminating groups of people might actually be done. As one political and human catastrophe after another has shown, mass murderous and eliminationist politics have been on the minds, flowed from the lips, and moved the hands of our age's leaders and followers alike. This past 100 years, humanity's most mass exterminationist and eliminationist period, has seen mass murder, mass expulsions, vast camp systems, and mass rape entering for the first time the consciousness of the entire world, especially that of political leaders. These practices have become an available and potent implement in politics' toolkit, readily and often successfully employed, and in many political leaders' and people's eyes, deserving hard-headed consideration, in part because such assaults are not seriously attended to by outside countries, let alone met with opposing and decisive force. With all humanity's mobilization into politics and the growing insecurity of political tyrants and their followers repressing their own society's members, in addition to the modern world's other specific features promoting eliminationist thinking, eliminationism has been ever more tempting and practiced on a hitherto unthinkable scale. This has produced two distinctive forms of mass murderous and eliminationist politics, in addition to the common focused or even iterative eliminationist assault. Some political leaders employ eliminationism as the extreme violent end of the continuum for dealing with political challenges or socially troublesome, unwanted, or disparaged groups in a still more politically foundational and sustained manner. They transform their countries into permanent, or at least semi-permanent, eliminationist entities, dependent upon a level of violence often institutionalized in extensive killing campaigns and camp worlds, far exceeding the conventional repressive measures used to control discontented populations. Often tied to broad and thoroughgoing transformative visions, these eliminationist civilizations, Nazi Germany, the Soviet Union, Communist China, Imperial Japan, Khmer Rouge Cambodia, and North Korea, include mass murder, expulsion, massive incarceration, and enslavement of peoples as a constituent feature, sometimes the constituent feature of their politics and societies. In addition to our time's imperial eliminations, from the Belgians in Congo and the Germans in Southwest Africa to the Chinese in Tibet and the Indonesians in Timor, a fearsome kind of eliminationism as politics, including in the Balkans and Central Africa, have developed. In both areas, reciprocal mass murdering and expulsions and ongoing eliminationist danger came to define the region's politics. The Balkans' politics, principally, though not exclusively, among Serbs, Croats, and Muslims, and Central African politics in Rwanda and Burundi, and now the Democratic Republic of the Congo, came to be characterized less by regime type, which ordinarily principally defines a country's politics, than by a politics of iterative and reciprocal mass murder and elimination in the thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, and in Congo, in the millions. Peace in certain times and regions has been but an interlude between wars. In these two regions, more conventional, if brutal, dictatorial and repressive politics have been but an interlude between mass murders and eliminations. A third instance, abruptly halted, occurred in Central and Eastern Europe. The Germans' continent-wide exterminationist and multidimensional eliminationist assault was followed by the non-apocalyptic counter-elimination, primarily expulsive, against ethnic Germans, mainly by peoples the Germans had victimized, some of whom could reasonably expect that radical measures were necessary to forestall future German assaults. Germany's long post-war occupation and political division, and in the West its gradual transformation into a pluralist democracy, were part of this radical political solution. In light of the many expelled, brutalized, and murdered ethnic German men, women, and children's enormous suffering, it was by far the better part. All modern tyrannies, including non-democratic regimes and formerly democratic countries substantially restricting or violating political rights and civil liberties, have a substantial eliminationist potential. This potential often lurks just beneath the surface of the less destructive, if still destructive, forms of political repression such regimes, by definition, practice. Nevertheless, important developments over several decades and the contemporary political context have removed several major sources of eliminationist politics. Imperial eliminationism is, by and large, over, unlikely to return in a world resembling our own. Local and small-scale imperial conquests and slaughters will likely occur. Yet the major powers that once practiced such assaults on a grand scale have tempered and transformed themselves. Nuclear weapons make the return of tyranny's grand imperial aspirations along the lines of mid-century Germany or Japan or the post-war Soviet Union all but unthinkable. Only the United States and China are positioned to act in this manner anytime soon. For all its necessary and discretionary entanglements around the world, the United States is extraordinarily unlikely to embark on eliminationist imperialism abroad. China, in the throes of capitalist transformation, is somewhat of a wild card and continues to demonstrate parochial eliminationism in Tibet, but its geostrategic territorial aspirations have always been local. China's accelerating development, while retaining extremely troubling features, is, on the whole, positive. Grand communist eliminationism is over. Communism, as a potent political ideology and force, is spent. Its economic model is discredited as an irredeemable failure. Communism is extraordinarily unlikely to return in a world evolving in any manner resembling ours. The anti-communist counter or preemptive slaughters and the mindsets and politics producing them have therefore also dissipated. A new democratic Germany ensconced in a new democratic and politically integrated Europe has replaced the great destructive force in the middle of Europe, Nazi Germany. The bulk of the continent has no realistic prospect of returning to the mass murderous or eliminationist past. More generally, the countries most capable of pursuing substantial regional eliminationist politics are far less likely to, owing to changes in the world and the country's greater mutually beneficial integration with each other and their regions. Globalization, its problems notwithstanding, promotes interdependent economies, increased cultural learning and shared outlooks, values and norms, and democratizing and non-internationally belligerent politics that greatly contribute to this less threatening domestic and international environment. Looking at the 10 most populous countries and the European Union, all having perpetrated or suffered eliminationist, including exterminationist, politics, we see that the number of those likely to again commit or suffer mass murder or elimination has dropped dramatically. Compared to almost all of their situations 60, 40, or 20 years ago, the overall probability of such human catastrophes looks more remote. These considerable positive developments are a prologue to a more promising future, and yet mass murder and elimination's reality and threat do continue. Some of the regimes, assaults, and dangers are familiar. Others are new. They portend possible disaster for millions upon millions of people and the world at large. Their constellation provides a prologue to another kind of future. Mass murder and eliminationist politics, as I have emphasized, even on a small scale of tens of thousands, let alone hundreds of thousands, are being practiced and remain non-trivial or even likely possibilities in many regions. Sub-Saharan African countries, characterized by tensions and conflicts among domestic groups and peoples, partly born of immense poverty, and mostly governed by tyrannical regimes, are still potentially rife for eliminationist onslaughts. The post-colonial reactions that produced the contexts for so many of our time's slaughters have partly worked themselves out. Yet the process is hardly complete, and the conflicts are far from fully resolved in many places. Similarly, many unstable and tyrannical regimes rule Asian countries, including some post-Soviet states. The problem with contemporary dictatorships and tyrannical regimes is threefold. As we see, and as I further discuss in Chapter 11, they are themselves proto-eliminationist entities domestically. They also more frequently covet neighbors' territory and therefore create the impetus for war and also for practicing eliminationist politics abroad. Because they do not allow for the development of civil society and the social and political resources for people and groups to learn how to accommodate themselves to each other, regulate conflicts, and find non-eliminationist solutions to problems, when the tyrannies finally end, they often leave behind eliminationist powder kegs. That happened in the former Yugoslavia, and this is what many fear for Iraq if the American presence becomes a short-lived interlude between Saddam Hussein's mass murderous regime and another eliminationist context. Even with the American and British presence, there have been low-level, somewhat under-the-radar, mutual eliminationist expulsions and steady murderousness by Sunni of Shia in Sunni-majority areas and by Shia of Sunni in Shia-majority areas, which each group's political leaders orchestrated and their various sectarian militias' eliminationist cadres carried out. One or several eliminationist assaults and bloodbaths could yet occur. In addition to the long-existing worrisome areas and regime types, two new systemic threats, for now greatly overlapping, must be confronted directly. Political Islam and eliminationist non-state actors, often referred to as terrorist groups. The new threats. Political Islam is a powerful transnational movement, with its adherents governing countries and vying for power in others, and with enormous political influence throughout the Middle East and the Islamic world. Several of its regimes have practiced mass murder and eliminationist politics more generally, and many of its regimes, national movements, and leaders openly threaten to do so. Political Islam is today's most dangerous eliminationist political movement. It has eliminationist civilizations' hallmark features: tyrannical regimes, eliminationist-oriented leaders, transformative eschatological visions, populaces brimming with eliminationist beliefs and passions, a sense of impunity, and eliminationism at the center of its normal political repertoire and existing practice. Political Islam is avowedly totalitarian. Its leaders and followers erase the distinction between politics and religion, wanting to merge politics with and subordinate it to Islam in a domestic, regional, and ultimately global rule of fundamentalist, intolerant versions of Islam, which differ from more tolerant, pluralistic forms that are practiced, including by most Muslim Americans. Hamas, one such political Islamic movement, officially called the Islamic Resistance Movement, established its totalitarian grip on Gaza in 2006. Shortly after gaining power, Musa Abu Marzouk, Hamas deputy chief leader in exile, said on Israeli radio, "One of the principles the group will never compromise is government according to the laws of the Sharia, the Quran's fundamentalist, anti-democratic, and anti-pluralist laws, which, after a period of consolidation, Hamas began to implement legislatively in December 2008. Political Islam's common ideological foundation and its overarching concerns give it a shared purpose for which its leaders and followers can singly and in concert work to compel all people already in Islamic countries to live according to Political Islam's dictates, pursue eliminationist strategies against non-Muslims, spread eliminationist hatred of them, and call openly for mass violence, jihad, and even mass murder. Bin Laden, nakedly revealing Political Islam's core eliminationist foundation and how its mass murdering is but an interchangeable eliminationist means for non-believers, demanded Americans' conversion to Islam as a non-negotiable condition for Political Islamists to stop fighting, meaning killing Americans. Political Islam has become the governing regime of countries, including Iran, Afghanistan, Sudan, Somalia, and others, quasi-states such as Hezbollah and Hamas and the Taliban after being dislodged from ruling Afghanistan, and non-state entities including Al-Qaeda. In many other countries, it is a powerful social and political movement. It already has as followers a good portion of the more than 1.2 billion Muslims in the world, though many Muslims find such politics anathema. Political Islam includes all those in power or vying for power, including secular leaders, using intolerant versions of Islam as a political ideology to mobilize Muslims at home or abroad for aggressive political action. Such politics are typically directed at those defying the political Islamic line, especially abroad against non-Muslims derogatorily called infidels. Political Islamists deem it lawful, even normative, their fatwas say this explicitly, to act against infidels in ways that would be criminal if done to Muslims. Political Islam's leaders and adherents have committed mass murder and practiced eliminationist politics, or explicitly threatened to do so in Iran, Sudan, and the Palestinian Authority, Hamas, by the political Islamic quasi-state and terrorist entities of Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Political Islam is currently the one expressly, publicly, and unabashedly genocidal major political movement. Because this movement is not Islam itself, but a political Islamic movement with a coherent and distinctive political ideology and goals, political Islam is a term preferable to Islamofascism, militant Islam, radical Islam, Islamic fundamentalism, etc. Identifying political Islam for what it is does not implicate Islam itself or all Muslims. Calling it political Islam and not one of the other terms in use clarifies that politics and not religion per se is the issue. The phenomenon includes only Islamic-grounded political regimes, organizations, and initiatives that share, whatever their other sometimes internecine differences, Shia versus Sunni, Arab versus Persian, etc., a common ideological foundation about Islam's political primacy or its need to systematically and politically roll back the West, a conviction that the fundamentally corrupt modern world must be refashioned, including by annihilating others. Therein, political Islam resembles the international communist movement in its heyday. Whatever its internal divisions and differences and antagonisms, it nonetheless sought to overcome putatively corrupt capitalism and reshape with violence the world according to its political ideology. Political Islam and its cohesion differs from the international communist movement, which relied on the Soviet Union's authority and leadership and political and economic support for its organization and discipline. Political Islam, whatever the Iranian monetary support flowing to some groups, is, without a coordinating structure, internationally cohering almost exclusively through powerful religiously grounded political ideology. Political Islam is many things: totalitarian, aggressive, conquering, cocksure about its superiority and destiny to rule, intolerant, bristling with resentment, only tenuously in touch with aspects of reality. These are the hallmark features of past and present eliminationist regimes. Even without additional attributes that promote exterminationist and eliminationist politics, these features alone, especially their totalitarian, aggressive, and fantastical worldview, make political Islamists, like our age's other such regimes, persistent threats to practice eliminationist politics. Yet political Islam's threat is still greater because, at its core, political Islam has three additional features exacerbating these common eliminationist tendencies. 1. The religious consecration of its tenets, emotions, and goals, putatively grounded in God's, that is, Allah's, will, and to which slavish devotion is due. 2. The reflexive, insistent public demonization of opponents, and 3. A culture of death. By creating powerful eliminationist views and a powerful eliminationist discourse now central to political Islamic politics, societies, and cultures, these three features have led political Islamists to see mass murder and eliminationist assaults as necessary and desirable politics. Political Islamists, as a matter of oratorical definition, invoke Allah and Islam's sacred text, the Quran, as inspiration, an eliminationist teaching tool, and to legitimize their political tyranny and eliminationist ideology and programs. This is not to say the Quran necessarily says what political Islamists claim for its individual passages or as a whole, or that it cannot be interpreted and reinterpreted to support non-tyrannical and non-eliminationist orientations. Like other ancient sacred texts and religions, the Quran and Islam can be tempered or renovated to be more compatible with pluralism, modernity's constituent feature. This has happened in various forms of Islam and Muslim communities in different countries. But it has not taken place in still many more countries, including by Islam's leading forms in most of the Middle East, where political Islam reigns or is a powerful insurgency against existing regimes, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, of which Hamas is a branch, which seeks to take power in Egypt, and the Taliban and their allies threatening Afghanistan and Pakistan. Political Islam's second critical aspect is its demonizing of opponents. Its ideology, more than intolerant of other political and social practices, demonizes those not accepting political Islam's suzerainty and ways, not converting to the prescribed form of Islam that a given political Islamist regime, movement, or group practices. Political Islam holds its self-declared enemies, often nothing other than holdouts, to be demonic in their apostasy or, especially, their active resistance or opposition. Fueled and consecrated by their religious interpretations, political Islamists demonize real and imagined foes seemingly reflexively because they deem those resisting political Islamists' dictates as violating Islam, holiness, and Allah. Political Islam therefore provides a ready-made conception of other people and groups that, in God's name, actively calls for their elimination one way or another. Political Islamists especially consecrate in their reading of Quranic texts, using lethal violence to bring about their enemies' elimination. Political Islam's third critical component promoting eliminationism is its culture, even cult, of death, which itself has several central features. Its foundation is the willingness to die, or at least to let political Islam's duped minions die, for political Islam's greater earthly and heavenly glory, and a place in paradise for the political religious martyr. It is astonishing how many people, many educated and middle class, gladly blow themselves up to commit mass murder and spread mass terror, demonstrating to the target people's every member that he or she can be slaughtered at any time, all in political Islam's service. This culture of death originates and is grounded in the account of the decisive legendary Battle of Qadisiyah in 636, leading to Islam's conquest of Persia. The commander of the Muslim army and the Prophet Muhammad's warrior, Khalid ibn al-Walid, sent a message to Khosrow, the Persian commander, before the battle. "You should convert to Islam and then you will be safe. For if you don't, you should know that I have come to you with an army of men that love death, as you love life. This willingness to die and to encourage others to martyr themselves for Allah is a regular glorified feature of Islamic societies and political movements, of media, sermons, and textbooks, and of political Islamists' slaughter of their enemies or mobilizing others to do so. It is rhetorically and behaviorally manifest throughout the movement, including in the well-known glorification of suicide bombers' deaths in their and their families' videotapes, public ceremonies, and its most prominent and powerful political leaders' speeches. Hamas's supreme leader Khaled Mashal's broadcast to the world in the wake of Hamas' election victory, "Today you are fighting the army of Allah. You are fighting against peoples for whom death for the sake of Allah and for the sake of honor and glory is preferable to life." Mashal and other major political Islamic leaders glorify death, disseminate its culture, and deepen its powerful and near-ubiquitous eliminationist discourse to its followers in speeches and sermons, before adoring crowds and in television broadcasts and over the internet, in interviews with reporters and educational material for children. In 9/11's aftermath, Osama bin Laden explained to a reporter, "We love death. The U.S. loves life. That is the big difference between us." Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah's leader, the architect in 2006 of the self-destructive war with Israel in Lebanon, and, at least for a time, the Arab world's most admired leader, similarly explained why political Islamists will triumph over the Jews. "We are going to win because they love life and we love death." According to Nasrallah, this political Islamic superiority can be explained by their Islamic faith. Nasrallah broadcast this in a televised speech explaining the joy of dying for Allah, the joy of killing Jews, and the connection between the two. "How can death become joyous? How can death become happiness? When Al-Hussein asked his nephew Al-Qusem, when he had not yet reached puberty, 'How do you like the taste of death, son?' he answered that it was sweeter than honey. How can the foul taste of death become sweeter than honey? Only through conviction, ideology, and faith, through belief and devotion. We do not want to live merely in order to eat, drink, and enjoy life's pleasures, and leave our homeland to Israel so it will slaughter it upon the altar of its aspirations, desires, hate, and historic vendettas. Therefore, we are not interested in our own personal security. On the contrary, each of us lives his days and nights, hoping more than anything to be killed for the sake of Allah. The most honorable death is to be killed, as the leader Imam Al-Khamenei said when Abbas Musawi was martyred. He said, 'Congratulations to Abbas! Congratulations to Abbas!' The most honorable death is death by killing, and the most honorable killing and the most glorious martyrdom is when a man is killed for the sake of Allah by the enemies of Allah, the murderers of the prophets, in other words, the Jews." Bin Laden, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, voice of the ruling mullahs, led since 1989 by the country's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Nasrallah and Mashal, and more broadly, sheikhs, intellectuals, and suicide bombers, and most fundamentally, the many who read and understand the Quran in this way, profess to love death and convince their followers, especially the children, to want to die and even more to slaughter those designated as Islam's enemies. Little is more chilling and more indicative of this death culture's power and reach than political Islamists' broadcasts and podcasts of music videos directed at children, depicting children happily and earnestly explaining that they want to die for Allah and take Islam's enemies with them. Another aspect of political Islamists' culture of death is the willingness to annihilate entire categories of opponents, and the openness to declaim this willingness, together with the drive to attain the requisite operational capability and weaponry. The euphemistic suicide bombing should really be called what it is, proto-genocide bombing, or more simply, as Canada's former Justice Minister Erwin Kotler has said, genocide bombing. Genocide bombers targeting civilians are saying that any people in a given country or adhering to a particular non-Islamic creed are fit to be slaughtered. Each genocide bombing, beyond the actual murders it perpetrates, symbolically mass murders everyone else it could have targeted, and is an installment in an ongoing assault of, if the perpetrators had their way, a stream, perhaps an unending torrent of genocide bombings. Political Islamists have avowed and sometimes centered their political programs around eliminating, even killing entire categories or enormous numbers of people, sometimes in the millions, among the groups or peoples they designate as enemies. When genocide bombers slaughter such a targeted group's members, the bombing's meaning and intent becomes that much more unmistakable. Political Islamists responding to something as seemingly trivial in the world of politics as the Danish cartoons of Islam's prophet Muhammad, published in 2005, with a wave of violent attacks on Western institutions, burnings of buildings and killings, as well as calls from many, leaders and followers alike, for the mass murder of those who, in their view, insulted or defamed the prophet. Calls to slaughter Islam's putative enemies, such as Death to Denmark in Pakistan, were the protests' commonplace. More specific death threats against publishers and cartoonists alike, including a $1 million bounty for the murder of the Danish cartoonist, seek to silence those political Islamists declare as enemies and to intimidate others into silence. A complementary event occurred shortly thereafter, with an august protagonist ordinarily treated with reverence, or at least utmost respect. In a university lecture in Germany in 2006, Pope Benedict XVI made an inept attempt at comparative religious enlightenment, in which he quoted a 14th century Byzantine emperor's deprecating statement about Islam in order to claim Christianity as the religion of reason. Leading political Islamists in different countries greeted this with calls to kill or imprison the Pope. Sheikh Abubakar Hassan Malin of the Supreme Islamic Courts Union, the political Islamic party that was ruling most of Somalia, declared at Friday evening prayers, "We urge you Muslims, wherever you are, to hunt down the Pope for his barbaric statements as you have pursued Salman Rushdie, the enemy of Allah who offended our religion." Proceeding according to political Islam's logic, Malin told the Muslim faithful that this applied not only to the Pope. Whoever offends our Prophet Muhammad should be killed on the spot by the nearest Muslim. The Mujahideen Shura Council, an umbrella organization for the political Islamic insurgency in Iraq, led by Al-Qaeda, issued a statement threatening the Pope and, because of him, all Christians. "We tell the worshipper of the cross, the Pope, that you and the West will be defeated, as is the case in Iraq, Afghanistan, Chechnya. What's more, we shall break the cross and spill the wine. God will help Muslims to conquer Rome. May God enable us to slit their throats and make their money and descendants the bounty of the Mujahideen." What do these and other such responses to a few uncomfortable, perhaps objectionable words tell us about this movement's murderousness? Never before in our time have significant religious and political leaders publicly called for the Pope to be killed. And to be sure, many political Islamic leaders, knowing the diplomatic catastrophe it would be to join this murderous chorus, contented themselves to echo, often in strikingly inflammatory terms, the common political Islamist condemnation for the Pope. This was all accompanied by church bombings, some killings, threats against Christians in Iraq and elsewhere in the political Islamic world, seemingly incessant and absurd invoking of the Crusaders, finger-pointing at Christians' real or alleged past crimes, and more. Mohammed Mahdi Akef, the political Islamic Muslim Brotherhood's supreme leader, said that Benedict's remarks threaten world peace and pour oil on the fire and ignite the wrath of the whole Islamic world to prove the claims of enmity of politicians and religious men in the West to whatever is Islamic. Threaten world peace? Whatever one thinks of the Pope's statement, the reaction was so wild, so disproportionate, so rhetorically and physically violent, so quintessentially political Islamic. Ill-chosen words, provocatively chosen words, an expression of, in the world of polemics and politics, rather mainstream views, inspired political Islamists to threaten the Pope with death. It is not only some putatively blasphemous cartoons or words that put people in the crosshairs of political Islamists, they also have standing targets. Hamas, as are other political Islamic governments, movements, and leaders, is armed with a hallucinatory anti-Semitic and murderous political Islamic ideology and practice formalized in its charter. This hefty manifesto, which Hamas has repeatedly reaffirmed, especially its core annihilative element, explains to Palestinians, other Arabs, and political Islamists around the world, and Westerners paying attention, political Islam's orientation toward Israel and the imperialist powers supporting Israel. In a Nazi-like anti-Semitic cascade of accusatory fancy, Hamas's charter casts Israel, Zionism, and Jews, used interchangeably, as seeking to demolish societies, to destroy values, to wreck answerableness, to totter virtues, and to wipe out Islam. Zionism, even, stands behind the diffusion of drugs and toxics of all kinds in order to facilitate its control and expansion. Hamas' charter calumnies Jews for a vast catalog of invented crimes against humanity, going to the anti-Semitic continuum's most outlandish end of maintaining that there was no war that broke out anywhere without the Jews' fingerprints on it. The charter explains that the Jews plan to subjugate the entire Middle East as a stepping stone to turning on the world. According to the charter, all Palestine, which includes all Israel and lands beyond, must succumb to Hamas' uncompromising political Islam. Israel, of course, must be destroyed. As the charter, A Call to Arms, says in its first paragraph, Israel will rise and will remain erect until Islam eliminates it, as it had eliminated its predecessors. The eliminationist ideology, which echoes countless political Islamic documents and leaders' statements, could not be more explicit, recalling past successes as a spur to redouble efforts toward its intended future one. They do not seek to destroy just Israel, the country. The Jews' very presence in what political Islamists deem Muslim land must be reversed. The charter is clear. Israel, by virtue of its being Jewish and of having a Jewish population, defies Islam and the Muslims. The genocidal and apocalyptic charter declares, Hamas has been looking forward to implement Allah's promise whatever time it might take. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, The time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them. Until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me. Come on and kill him. Allah's promise is the Palestinians, indeed all Muslims, command. Showing that Allah's promise pertains beyond Israel, governing political Islam's desired treatment of all non-Muslim peoples, Mahmoud Zahar, Hamas co-founder and later its foreign minister, declared to Italy's Il Giornale in February 2006, in reference to the cartoons, We should have killed all those who offend the Prophet. A genocidal principle common among political Islamists, as those calling for killing Pope Benedict also enunciated, that obviously translates into killing anyone ever offending the Prophet. Author's note. Although political Islamists' mass murderous and eliminationist orientation has not only Israelis, but also Jews squarely in its sights, In December 2006, 37% of British Muslims said British Jews are legitimate targets as part of the struggle for justice in the Middle East. Violent eliminationism is by no means exclusively or even principally directed at Jews or Israel.